A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Sigrid Nunez, the New York Times bestselling author of The Friend, winner of the 2018 National Book Award, and its follow-up, What Are You Going Through?, which has just been published by Virago here in the UK. Sigrid is the author of several other novels, including A Feather on the Breath of God, The Last of Her Kind, and Salvation City, and one volume of memoir, Semper Susan, a memoir of Susan Sontag. Welcome to Our Shelves, Sigrid. It's a huge pleasure to have you here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I've just realized that in describing your new novel, What Are They Going Through?, I said it was a follow-up to The Friend. And I'm assuming a sort of connection between the two books that I'm not sure I should be. But there are obviously sort of similarities in some of the themes. But it also struck me that when I was reading What Are You Going Through? That I was back in the same narrator's voice that I come across in The Friend. And I don't know, am I reading too much into it, or is there supposed to be a connection between the two books?
You're not reading too much into it. The truth is that I certainly didn't plan for this book to greatly resemble The Friend. I wasn't even thinking about that. I was just writing a new book. But it didn't take me long to discover exactly what you said. That there was a connection, and that the most important connection was that it was the same narrator's voice, that it is the same narrator, I think. So I never intended to write a sequel, and I wouldn't call it a sequel, so maybe follow-up might be a little too explicit, but these mm-hmm. books are definitely, as you say, connected. And surely, What Are You Going Through? Came out of The Friend.
Is it as a narrator's voice that you've come across before in your writing? Again, I don't want to make too many sort of connections, but it sort of, I don't know, it struck me as something similar to your first novel, A Feather on the Breath of God, that the very sort of intimate, quiet tone of the narrator's voice. And I wonder if, not necessarily that they're exactly the same people, but when you write when you find a particular narrative voice like this, does it remind you of things that you've written in the past, or do you think of all the books as being completely independent entities?
Well, again, you're describing something that did in fact happen. When I wrote The Friend, when I finished The Friend, I thought to myself, you know, this really comes out of my first novel, A Feather on the Breath of God, published in 1995, whereas The Friend was published in 2018. I recognized, again, without planning it, I recognized the similarities in the voice and in the way of seeing the world and the sensibility of the narrator. And I thought, yes, that really is like the same narrator here in The Friend, decades older. So now, but other books that I've written are far from that, don't fit into this pattern we're talking about. But you know, when I think I did write a book about a woman who served as an army nurse in Vietnam called Rowena, and there is a narrator there who's also a writer. And when I think about how she begins the book and then she withdraws from the book so she can tell the story of this nurse's experiences in the war and coming home from the war. I feel that that narrator, that unnamed narrator, who's also a writer, I think she too fits in to this group. So there are these four books that I think do share a narrator, a character who is a narrator and a writer who are very similar, and in some cases, it seems to me the same.
Mm. Well, that was the other one I was going to ask you about, actually, because again, the similarities seemed, it's the voice, the kind of, and there's something so, as a reader at least, there's something so wonderful to re-encounter a voice which you've enjoyed spending time with before. And not in that classic way of thinking, yes, this is a sequel, I'm going to kind of, you know, see another, be able to kind of put their life together as a sort of jigsaw, but just to be back in with that voice again, I think was very, very sort of rewarding as a reader in as my experience at least here, because if you said that you didn't start writing, you know, the friend and then maybe and what are you going through, recognizing that this was going to be the same narrator that you might have encountered before, the same narrative voice, how did it feel in the moments where you suddenly realized that it was? Is it like meeting an old friend of your own back again and thinking, oh, I recognize you, I see you, you're the person?
Well, it feels comfortable. I feel like once I recognized that in writing, What Are You Going Through, that was a very good thing because, you know, I was familiar with this narrator character from The Friend, and that wasn't that long ago. So I felt like I was where I should be as the narrator of the book, and I felt that I was going to be able to say what I wanted to say and tell the stories I wanted to tell with consistency. That was very important to me. You know, that I would be able to, I didn't have doubts about being able to keep the tone and the voice consistent, which is very important in a book like this. But that I already knew what that was, and I had that, and that was a big part of the battle of getting a book done.
Mm. That strikes me as well. The way you say that the voice, the tone, was where you felt like you needed to be, where you had to be, and that reminds me a little bit of a wonderful line in a recent review you got from Dwight Garner in the New York Times, one of the many kind of rave reviews you've been getting. But he says this kind of very almost like a throwaway comment, but to me, it struck me as being very important to your books. He says, when I open one of her, that is your novels, I almost always know immediately, this is where I want to be. And not only did it make me feel very similar, that he was articulating something which I had failed to put into words, that when I pick up your books, regardless of what the topic is, you know, who your narrator is, I think, oh, this is where I want to be in this moment. This is exactly what I should be reading. But it's so interesting to hear you talk about the writing process in sort of such a similar vein.
Well, I think that that has something to do with the intimacy of the tone. I mean, I'm not sure, but it might have something to do with the feeling on the part of the reader that I am talking to you.
Yes.
You know, very, very directly. I'm not talking about you. I have a story to tell. I'm talking about other people and how I feel and how I think and so on. The narrator, I say I, meaning the narrator. But there is a kind of sense of being spoken to as if there were a very close relationship between the writer and the narrator and the reader.
Mm. That sort of intimacy as well. It feels very... I think intimate is the exactly right word. I feel that it is a personal connection that I'm making in that moment, which is not something that happened. And so many books, I think, strive to achieve that, and not all are as successful as you are in the process, I think, anyway. Well, now I'd like to talk a little bit about you as a reader, Sigrid, rather than the writer. I've asked you to tell me about some books that are currently on your bedside table, assuming that that's the place where there's a pile of books waiting for you.
Yes. One book that I'm really looking forward to reading is Helen MacDonald's new book of essays about the natural world called Vesper Flights. Mm-hmm. And I was a huge fan of H's for Hawk. And, you know, I was very, you know, when I think about writing The Friend, I think, you know, I think of that book, and you know, Helen MacDonald was so undone by grief after her father's sudden death. And I just thought the story was so beautiful and so beautifully told, this healing power of a relationship that she had with a goshawk. Mm. So that was actually very much on my mind when I was working on The Friend. And I you know, I think that she, her belief that animals can teach us many important things, not just about their worlds, but about ourselves. I think that that's true, and that it's a wonderful observation. And also this idea of how much of a comfort to us animals are, and not just dogs. I mean, mainly dogs, but in her case, it was the goshawk. So some of those essays have appeared in various places. So I've read some, but I'm really looking forward to that. And then another book is Natasha Trethewey's memoir, Memorial Drive, which also just came out recently. So I have met Natasha Trethewey, who is a poet, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, and also our United States Poet Laureate for 2 years, in 2012 and 2013. And she, I met her because we were both on the faculty at the Breadloaf Writers Conference more than once. And this this memoir is about a very terrible thing that happened to her. She was 19 years old when her stepfather shot and killed her mother in Atlanta. And so apparently in this book, she talks about how her relationship with her mother, of course, and how this violence shaped her poetry and her life. And also she talks about being the growing up a child of mixed race in the American South, in Mississippi, in fact. And she's a wonderful poet. And I particularly like reading the prose of poets. I find it's often very wonderful. I think about the stories written by the great poet Elizabeth Bishop, for example. Mm. And I once tried that. You know, I once tried in one of my literature courses in graduate school to teach a course called A Poet's Prose. And I thought it was such a wonderful idea. And I had all kinds of works. And it didn't go well for some reason. I really don't know why. You know, the students didn't take to it. So I didn't try that experiment again. But when I came up with it, I thought it was a quite a wonderful idea.
I would have thought that would have been a very attractive.
It sounds great. It sounds great. But then you just don't know what's going to happen. And then the Emily Ruskovich was a writer that I didn't know anything about her. Then she won last year's International Dublin Literary Award. And I've heard so many wonderful things about this book called Idaho. Mm. And it sounds like a really good mystery, among other things, if I'm not misrepresenting it. I've heard that it's extraordinarily well written as well. But it's about a couple who are living in northern Idaho, in a very rugged part of the state. And they've been together for a long time. He's losing his memory. And she's trying to find out the truth about what really happened to his first wife, who's actually in prison, and their daughters. So, and then another book that really fascinates me, but I worry that it might be over my head, to be honest, is this X plus Y, A Mathematician's Manifesto for Rethinking Gender by Eugenia Cheng, who is a mathematician and also a concert pianist. And I'm not sure I quite understand it, but apparently she uses insights of mathematics to suggest a new way to talk about human character traits without reference to gender, so that, you know, a way of reframing our accepted perspective, that biology is the way to talk about gender difference. In her view, that it doesn't have to be that way. That's a bias. So as somebody who's really bad at math, this could be challenging, but my understanding is that she's an expert at making mathematical ideas clear to people like me. So I will certainly give it a try. And then I wanted to add one that's just come actually to me, called The High House by Jesse Greengrass. And this is a book coming out in the UK in April, I believe. And I'm really looking forward to this novel because I read Sight a couple of years ago. She had written a book of stories, but Sight was her first novel. It's kind of a hybrid work. It's a book about grief, one thing. Her being completely undone by the death of her mother, and also a kind of obsessive exploration about, should I have a child and why is it so difficult for me to make this decision, though you know from the very beginning of the book that she did indeed decide to have a child because that's on the first page. But she also interlards that personal story with a lot of essayistic science writing that I found absolutely fascinating and that was completely appropriate to the other story that she was telling. It wasn't like some kind of filler. So I admire her a lot. So I'm very happy that this was sent to me. So those are some things.
Perfect. I'm wondering, I don't know if this is quite a broad observation to make, but it strikes me that some of the, or a fair amount of the books you've just described sort of speak to your own writerly interests, if I can put it that way, whether it's sort of in grief or a particular kind of voice. I wonder if you find, do you find that your own writing informs what you read, or do you try and keep a sort of bit of a separation between the two?
I don't actually try anything, but I certainly would, one way or the other, I think I'm kind of reading whatever it is that I want to read. And I would certainly prefer that I could be, as broad as possible. But I suppose, just as you noticed, there are these particular concerns that I have that I think, clearly are coming out in what I'm putting on that nightstand. I think you're absolutely right.
One of the sort of big pleasures for me, at least, of reading both The Friend and What Are You Going Through are the sort of intertextual pleasures, the way that the narrator incorporates books that she's read, stories that she's heard. And it seems so sort of organic and natural in the novels that we read. I just wondered whether it was something that you're aware of doing, that you think, oh, that'll slot into the story here. Or do you think in advance, I want to talk about these sort of subjects? Or do you find in the writing process that you suddenly realize that you want to mention a reference from, a novel you read 10 years ago or something like that?
Oh, it's definitely the latter, because one of the things I like about having a narrator who's a reader and a writer is that it's convincing that she would quote other writers.
Yes.
So what I do is I'm moving along with my story. I'm not planning anything ahead or even remembering and then moving towards that memory of something that I read. I come to a certain place and then I think, oh, yes, for example, that reminds me of how so-and-so said or wrote. And then I'm able to put it in there. And what very often happens is that once I put that in there, that leads to another thought, which could perhaps be something else that I read that or even a film that I saw or something that I heard. So it would always be something that came in the process of writing. And that's what I like about it, because it feels very natural, because it has actually happened to me while I'm writing and thinking. I think that it helps give that intimate tone that we talked about before, like something that's happening in the moment, like a conversation that I'm having with the reader.
Yes. Well, that's the thing. It feels like a kind of everything about when you read it, it feels very organic. It feels that it's a natural, the way that, you know, we're used to our own thoughts zinging off one another and thinking about something we read a while ago or making the connections. So it seems so organic in the process and very admirable as well. So the second question I want to ask you is about a recent article that's made you think about something in particular.
Well, I found it helpful during lockdown and these rolling crises that we're living through. It's been a pleasure to me and a comfort to read about creatures or about the natural world. And so I had discovered these little pieces. They're usually not more than 1,000 words, by Catherine Rundell in the London Review of Books, where she considers some creature. And there was a wombat, a narwhal, a hermit crab, a hedgehog, a hare, swifts, the pangolin, the golden mole, and lemurs. I think that might be all of them so far. And so the pieces are, consider the creature. And these are very beautiful pieces. I mean, they're very poetical, and they're full of extremely interesting information that I've never seen before. For example, she starts out the one about the hermit crab, that saying that it's possible that a hermit crab ate Amelia Earhart, because there are these giant, I mean, this is a wonderful way to start the little piece, because there are these giant coconut hermit crabs on the island where she went down, with jaws that are capable of breaking a coconut. Apparently, this has been tested. Who would think? But there's a lot of humor in them. There's a lot of lightness. And she has wonderful descriptions. For example, when she's talking about the hedgehog, she describes the face as that distinctive look of polite, gracious inquisitiveness. Now, online, you have the photographs, color photographs of these various animals, which are also a treat. And she always includes a history of the animal, and the various myths that have been believed about the animal over time. So anyway, they're great fun and they're really beautiful, and her language is very, very precise. So that's a treat. It isn't really such an escape from the harsh realities of the world, because she always, I mean, the really sad thing is that every one of these animals, as I can recall, is endangered. And she always goes into that. What is it that is endangering them? What is it that is ruining their habitat? So there's always this, there's always this acknowledgement and always on the part of the reader having to face, you know, as a human being, the complicity in the harm that we're doing these animals that she has just written so beautifully about. But I do greatly appreciate the writing of these pieces, and I'm very, really looking forward to them.
I've read a couple of them, probably not quite as many as you, and I've noticed that they sort of both take you out of the world in as much as she is showing you something that, well, for me at least, she's sort of introducing me to an animal that I sort of know, you know, what it looks like. I know a little bit about it, but then she tells me this sort of whole other story about how, sometimes about how it exists, but also the way that we have, or humans have a relationship with it, what it might mean in terms of mythology or how we've come to view some of these animals. And I was sort of, once you picked them, I was wondering about what is it that makes for good writing about animals? Because you've done it yourself so wonderfully. I mean, not just in The Friend, where you've got your wonderful Apollo, the Great Dane that your narrator has to look after. And that is such a beautiful friendship that you sort of render on the page, you know, between woman and dog. But also in your earlier book, Mitts, about Leonard Woolf's pet marmoset, which is such a wonderful sort of story that you told, such a brilliant, I mean, it's inspired that somebody would want to write that story. But clearly there was sort of an attraction there. And what there's something about animals, which obviously you're quite drawn to.
Yes, I think, I think first of all, you have to have a love of them, which so many people have. And then you have to find them fascinating. You have to find animal behavior really fascinating. And then you have to be willing there are people who say this is very bad, you know, anthropomorphizing is not a good thing. But you do need to, I think, see personalities in the animals. I mean, when she talks about the hedgehog's look of inquisitiveness, you know, that's animals can be so, but we think of, that we understand is something, yes, animals are curious, inquisitive, we've seen that. But the other two adjectives, polite, gracious, these are we think of these as human traits. I think you have to be willing to use your imagination to see a kind of humanity in the animal world. It's not the way a scientist would look at it, I suppose. But I think that's really it. And I do have that. I'm absolutely fascinated by animals and animal behavior. And I like the look of them too. I like looking at them. I like observing the way they go about their animal business. Some people are bored by that, but I think most people aren't. I think most people really enjoy watching animals when they have the opportunity.
Yeah, I think because there seems to be two, there's obviously sort of always this kind of line when people are writing about animals. Are you writing about a human's relationship with an animal, or are you writing about the animal in its own sort of right? And of course, there is always that urge to sort of impose human characteristics, particularly when somebody, whether it's, you know, in real life or whether it's a character in a book, feels a sort of strong relationship with an animal. I think I find myself in, because I wouldn't really count myself a particularly animal, I'm not really an animal person. I'm not a huge fan of having pets, but I find reading about animals incredibly fascinating. Maybe because it shows me, it sort of lets me into a world that I'm not that comfortable with in real life. I don't know what it is exactly. But I never thought something like The Friend would be a particularly interesting book, but actually, you know, everything about Tulip in it, obviously Tulip as well, the J.R. Akeley, that sent me wanting to read that book as much as want to read about Apollo. So there's something there. I think animals are really fascinating.
Well, but there is one other thing that I'd say, which is that although I do have a cat who speaks for itself in What Are You Going Through? I was very very conflicted about that, because much as I love animals, love reading about animals, love writing about animals, observing them, I've never been a fan of the first person animal. I don't like it when there are stories about an animal and they have the you know, Mrs. Beaver. She's wearing an apron and she's making tea, and her family is around the table, and the Mr. Beaver has overalls on. He's going to work, because I don't feel those are humans. Animals don't speak. Animals don't speak English. They don't write books. They don't have a human life. They don't wear overalls. All those things. So you would think that I would, as an animal, as a child, yes, I could love that, you're not really writing about the animal. You're writing about people in animal costumes, and this is not so interesting to me.
Yeah. What, when you went back and forth about writing the cat, I mean, I think the cat section in What Are You Going Through really works. It's sort of, it's strange, but it also makes perfect sense within the world that you've created in the book, which is sort of odd in one sense. But did you go back, you obviously went back and forth about whether to include it or not?
Well, the, yes, I again, like everything I write, it happens to me in the process. So at this point, I have the narrator who's very sleepy. She's in bed. She's reading her mystery. She's about to go to sleep. And the cat comes into the room. It's not her cat. She's at an Airbnb. And the cat jumps on the bed. And that's very nice. She's very happy with that. And then the cat has a story to tell, like so many other people. Like so many people in the book. but I do suggest that my narrator is falling asleep. You don't really know whether the cat was speaking or she's had this dream, because at the end she says the cat told many other stories that night, but this is the only one I remembered when I woke up. So I didn't know whether it was a dream or the cat was real. Now, when I have said this to readers, they are almost indignant that I would suggest that it was just a dream. readers insist that it was real and that the cat was speaking. So I guess that must be it. And I did, as I say, you know, I did wonder if this worked, this part about the cat. And I thought, well, if it doesn't, my editor is going to tell me that. My editor is going to gently suggest I would cut the cat. But in fact, the editor and everyone else is so taken with the cat. The cat turns out to be something of a scene stealer. So I'm glad it's there.
This is a very memorable part of the novel, and I think works particularly well. So moving on to something a little bit different, perhaps, could you tell me about a song? I think you're going to tell me about some songs that you've been listening to a lot lately.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I guess, I read that there was a new biography of the singer Odetta. And I remembered listening to Odetta's music in the 60s, but I hadn't listened to it for a really long time. So I've been looking for things on YouTube. Now, Odetta is somebody who was classically trained, and I have tried to find her singing German Lieder, but I haven't been successful at that. But she did actually turn to folk music. I mean, she could sing anything. So she sang folk music, spirituals, blues. She sang a lot of Dylan. Some of the songs that I've listened to over and over are Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child, All My Trials, Careless Love, these various Dylan songs. She's just it's an amazing voice. I mean, it's just an enormous and an extraordinarily beautiful voice, and her musicality is just stunning. And she was a hero to the folk music movement. And there's one concert that she she's doing a blues improv with Joan Baez. And it begins with Joan Baez singing, and then she appears, and they have the arms around each other. And in her, I guess, her right hand, she has a cigarette. I'm so fixated on the cigarette. She comes out to sing with a cigarette, and she's moving and swaying with Joan Baez, and her hand is there with the cigarette. And that was a wonderful thing to listen to. And her life, you know, she was born in 1930, and she's born in Birmingham, and she is Birmingham, Alabama, and she is somebody that I also associate with the civil rights movement. She sang at the march, the same march that Martin Luther King Jr. Made his "I Have a Dream" speech. And she was supposed to sing it at Obama's inauguration, I believe. And she died right before.
Oh.
So, yeah, so it's been wonderful listening to these.
I couldn't work out it. I was wondering, because I think I'd heard somebody else talking about the biography recently, so I was slightly aware of who she was. But I must admit that I wasn't particularly familiar with her or her songs before that. And I couldn't work out if that was because my musical knowledge is pretty poor at the best of times, or whether she's just not quite so well known here in the UK. But what I've listened to is absolutely wonderful. And sort of, she sounds like an absolutely fascinating character as well, an incredible sort of life, and at the forefront of these very political movements as much as the kind of musical side of things as well.
Well, and I think she hasn't been... she hasn't been getting very much attention in recent years, I think. But I think there was a period of time where she took off. I seem to remember somewhere, I mean, took off from singing in one of these where it said her first concert after a silence of 10 years or something. So, I mean, she must have retired or pulled out. But it would be great if this biography, I think there are actually two books about her out right now, I think it would be great if people would start to rediscover her, because I mean there was a time when that's why the one name, she did have a surname, it was Holmes. I mean everybody knew who Odetta was.
Yeah, I also I wonder, are you finding at the moment as well that is it not that strange to be listening to music in your apartment rather than out and about? Are you finding obviously things much more curtailed and having to do a lot more cultural devour your cultural content at home rather than out and about at the moment?
It's hard. I mean, particularly because so much is this little laptop. I mean, it's like... the whole universe, everything you do is except for cook, is the laptop. Right before lockdown, I was at a concert at Carnegie Hall, and I often think how long before I would be doing that again. The Metropolitan Opera House has just canceled its entire year. Next year.
Yes, I saw that. That's kind of shocking. I mean, I understand why, but it's such a blow to the arts, right?
Yeah, and I think Carnegie Hall will have to do the same in other places, and so there's that particular kind of cultural event is gone. Museums aren't there. You can do that, and of course you can read, but I do really miss. Consciously, even more though, not being able to go to the movies—that's even more of a loss at the moment, and not knowing when that will come back, because that's a completely different thing from watching movies at home. Completely different, because that's what I want to do, is go to the film forum and be with other people in the dark and watch the movie. I don't want to sit here watching Netflix.
I know it's not quite the same feeling, is it? I mean, there are certain things you can still watch, but that idea of escaping from it all, of sort of taking time out of your day to go and sit in a dark movie theater and be transported, it's never going to work in your own home in quite the same way. So regardless of how big your screen is or anything like that. So, it's a shame we're all missing these things, I think. Our shells will be back in just a moment.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes and I'm talking to Sigrid Nunez about the loss of cinema at the moment. We're both missing being able to go and see things on the big screen, unfortunately. So sticking with the visual image for the time being, the next question we've asked is for you to pick a photograph that you treasure. And I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about it, please, Sigrid.
Well, I have here... My photograph is from a book, and the book is called Author Photo. And these are portraits by the photographer Marion Ettlinger from 1983 to 2002. And Marion Ettlinger only does author photos. That is her great subject. So in 1983, she did a portrait of Elizabeth Hardwick, who is...
Oh, wow.
Who was in New York City in her apartment. And Elizabeth Hardwick was, among other things, the first professional writer I ever met. Now, in this photograph, it's actually, she's looking very pensive. She's looking down, leaning her chin on her hand and her elbow on the side of her couch. I met her when I was a student at Barnard College, and she was teaching the fiction workshops there, and I took two fiction workshops with her. But this was, you know, very important because I had thought that I was a poet, that I was going to be a poet, I should say. And that's how I identified myself as a writer. So my first semester at Barnard, I took a poetry workshop, which was a disaster. There's just no other way to put it. I'll tell you how much of a disaster it was. It was such a disaster that, and I'm not joking, I never wrote a poem again. I never...
Really?
I would not have dared. It was a terrible experience. It was a frightening experience. One of the reasons was that in this workshop, the teacher thought it was a good idea for all of the manuscripts that were submitted to be talked about by fellow students, be anonymous. So no one had to own what they were saying. And it just so happens that everyone, from the teacher to every student, hated, mocked, destroyed whatever poem I wrote anonymously.
Oh, no.
Not the teacher. So that's why. So I could have quit writing completely at that point. As I say, I never, to this day, I have never written another poem. Then I moved on and I took Elizabeth Hardwick's two fiction workshops. And she was extremely extremely tough too. But she was very, very important to me. And as I say, she was the first professional writer that I ever met. So by the time this photograph was taken in 1983, I was out of school, of course, but I also, she had written her novel Sleepless Nights, which came out in 1979. And she also had written there had been collected her wonderful essays on women and literature called Seduction and Betrayal. And in fact, it was her writing that was the big influence on me. She was not a great writing teacher. There was a part of her that didn't really believe that it could even be done. And this just so happened when I was studying with her, it happened to have been an extremely traumatic period in her own life. But it was from there that I ended up working at the New York Review of Books after I graduated. And I stayed in touch with her for years. And so she was always an important influence. And she was always extremely critical. Extremely critical. And in fact, my relationship with her was very complicated because, among other things, I would show her something, or she would read a book of mine, and she wouldn't say anything about it, but then I would hear from other people that she had liked it or admired it, but she wouldn't say that to me. So it was very...
That's very strange. Very
complicated, yeah. Yeah, and she would also... Another interesting thing was that she was very concerned about, that I was likely to find unhappiness as a writer, as in her view, so many people, particularly women, do. And so she's always trying to, encourage the other side of life. So, so she was always asking me about whatever boyfriend I had. And so, as the years passed, instead of asking me, "How's the writing coming?" She would always say, "Do you still have that nice young man?" And that meant, so what happened then was I broke up with that nice young man, and I kept telling her that I still had him because I didn't want to hear her harsh, how did she put it when I would break up with somebody? "Oh, don't tell me that you've lost another one," she would say. So I kept lying to her, and then she found out, and then she wasn't so harsh. But I just didn't want her to know that I had lost another one. So anyway, I want to say about these the photographs. Okay, also in this book, I met Marian Ettlinger around 1995, and she then took a photograph of me, which is actually my favorite. Yeah, she took this for the hardcover edition of Knits, and it remains my, although she's done other photographs of me, but this one remains my favorite photograph of me forever. And then, of course, on the back here, so it's really three photographs. This is beautiful Marian. This is beautiful Marian herself. So anyway, this book is full of extraordinary photographs. And when I was going about my life, becoming a writer, continuing as a writer, I would often think that I never imagined that I would be one of her subjects and that I would end up in a book of photos along with Elizabeth Hardwick. So these photographs have a lot of meaning and resonance for me.
Yes, of course. I'm very interested to hear you talk more about Hardwick and your relationship with her as well, and the sort of influence, because you do mention her briefly in your memoir about Susan Sontag. And for me, reading that, I've always thought of them as these kind of, obviously she doesn't get as much screen time, as it were, as Sontag, but she's this other sort of like two poles. They're obviously these incredibly brilliant women, very different in their way of living and writing, but they clearly both had a sort of effect on you. And so hearing about Hardwick a little bit more is particularly interesting. I find it sort of fascinating that she wouldn't tell you what she thought about your work. Did you ever confront her about that and sort of say, "Read this and let me know what you think about it"? Or did you just let it slide and let yourself find out through what other people told you?
Well, in the beginning, when I was her student, and I would go to her office when I was a graduate student right across the street at Columbia, I would still go see her at Barnard and show her my work. And there she was, like the workshop teacher. There she would look at the work and talk about it. None of it was published. And she was extremely harsh. I mean, there was, for example, I was still a student, a graduate student, but I was a student, an unpublished student. And there was a time when she would get very impatient with the work. The work was bad. She very, very annoyed. She'd become very annoyed. And so she said, do you know what I see in your work? I see the mark of the amateur on every page. Now, remember, I was still a student, wow. Right? But she's so impatient. And or to another student that she had, she had said, I would rather shoot myself than read that again. She's also very funny, I have to say. You know, she said things to students that you would never, no one would ever say now. But then, you know, as time went on and I would publish books, those she wouldn't, she usually wouldn't, she might say something, but she wouldn't say a lot. And she certainly wouldn't praise, I mean, very much. But I would hear from other people. And then a very telling thing, she said to me, oh, I saw your friend. And she mentioned this person, and she said, and I said to him, you know, I'm so mean to Sigrid. She called me Sigrid. I'm so mean to Sigrid. But, you know, she's just such a nice person. She still wants to see me. She's still willing to be my friend. And apparently he said to her, well, that's because she's serious. So she was aware of it, but you know, it's just the way she was. I mean, she was quite a bit older than Susan Sontag, and she was much more conventional than Sontag about life. And she really did not think that a person should be alone, particularly a woman. And so that was an important part of things for her. And for example, I'm not sure if I probably do mention it in Sempre Susan, you know, where there was a moment with one of those boyfriends, I guess before I lost him or whatever, where I told her that I was thinking of having a child. And I remember so distinctly, she was very happy with that. And she said, now that's one decision you'll never regret. And that,
wow,
that stayed with me my whole life, because what I felt was behind it, you know what I mean? As opposed to this crazy idea you have about writing and being a professional writer. Do you know what I mean? It was like, and it certainly wasn't personal. I didn't think, oh, she's, you know, it's about Sigrid. That's, you know, you'll never regret. She meant as a woman, as a person. But she wouldn't have said that to a man.
No,
I don't think. Well, that could be
very
wrong.
Strange.
I don't think she would have said that to a man. But yeah, and of course, Susan Sontag was the opposite of that. You know, she was all for you put the work first. The work works, and for whatever else happens, the work is the most serious thing. You put everything there, whatever else. You can have 10 children if you want, but you know, this is what you want to do, and you should take it as seriously as you possibly can, or you'll never produce anything worthwhile. And of course, what I loved about both of these women was how serious they were, and the work that they did. I mean, Elizabeth Hardwick's writing is extraordinarily good, and Sleepless Nights was a book that had, you know, a tremendous influence on my own writing.
Yeah. Do you think you have, I mean, would you say, looking back on your career thus far, have you taken it incredibly seriously? Have you always put the work first? Has it been the sort of guiding light of your life?
I have. And it's what I wanted to do. You know, you know, as I've said, I'm one of those people, the opposite of Susan Sontag, who's always only wanted to do one thing well. That's my temperament. That's, you know, I one of the reasons why Susan Sontag's life was hard was because she had so many interests. There were so many things she wanted to do besides write, and she was always feeling guilty about that. And I've known other people like that. But there was a period of time when I was very young where I wanted to be a ballet dancer, but that was a fantasy. That was not going to happen anyway. So you could say that my whole life, this is the one thing I've wanted to do. I've wanted to do it really well. I've wanted everything else to be secondary to it.
Mm. It's really, I find that very heartening to hear, I think, and comforting as well on a certain level, that one can devote oneself to doing something and doing it well for such a long time and also get so much happiness out of it and sort of pleasure in the writing process and being able to do that and sort of the dedication, which I think sometimes I feel that we live in a world where there's so much, particularly in the publishing world these days, there's so much emphasis given to sort of this crazy new talent or this person writing this novel. And then, you know, their debut comes out and they sort of they drop off the radar for whatever reason. You know, maybe it's not a long, but the sort of longevity of a writing career, somebody who just sort of sits down, puts the work in and develops something over years and years is a sort of, I don't know, we're not so used to it anymore. I mean, it's harder to do. It's harder to earn money doing that as well, obviously. But it's a sort of, it's a strange way of thinking about things, I think, sometimes now. Also, I think just going back briefly, can I just ask, because obviously you do quite a lot of teaching yourself these days, don't you? And I just wondered whether, did your relationship that you had with Hardwick or any particular tutor back in, you know, when you were studying, has it affected the way that you've taught over the years yourself?
Well, it has very much. I mean, I've actually done a lot less teaching than it might seem, because I've never really had a teaching job. It's true that there was a period in my life not that long ago where I was doing quite a bit of it. I was taking whatever people were offering. I was taking it on to see just how much I could do and still write. But earlier on, I kept the teaching to an absolute minimum because that too I wanted to be absolutely. I wanted not to interfere with my writing, but yes, here's what I always kept in mind: the damage that was done to me in that poetry class. The fact that what happened there, which again was not personal, nobody said let's get Sigrid or let's end Sigrid's wish dream to be a writer. It just was allowed to happen. So I had to keep in mind that you can discourage somebody badly enough to stop them from writing at a time when they're so young. You know, there's no reason to be discouraging anybody. Mm-hmm. So there was that. And then also, you know, certain ways of being critical. Another famous Elizabeth Hardwick remark was, I tried to read your story. I really wanted to, but I just couldn't finish it. It was just so boring. You know, these things that she would say all the time. So you don't want to be like that. On the other hand, I feel incredibly lucky that I had these people like Sontag and Hardwick who were not just going to praise and who were going to be honest and who were going to say, you want to do this? This is really serious. This is not about your ego. It's not about your self-esteem. In fact, it's not about you at all. You know, it's about the work. Mm. And this will not do. Because now, of course, there's a tendency, there simply is, I see it everywhere, to coddle and flatter the student writer. And the thing is, the students themselves, as you later find out, are grateful if you are hard on them. If they respond very well, you know. Sometimes it's the departments that think they have to be a certain way. The students themselves, I find, can be taken aback sometimes because they're not used to it. But in the end, they really appreciate that you take the time and effort to go over and over it and to pick at everything and to say things like, you know, you have to interrogate every sentence or all these things. So I'm glad that I had these harder than usual mentors. I'm sure it helped my, I mean, how could it not have helped my work?
any student who is serious about their writing would want that, the sort of constructive criticism that's necessary. They'd want to kind of take on board and learn from it. You know, nobody does a course like that in order to just have praise heaped on them, because why would you be there in the first place if your writing was, you know, at that stage, right? So yeah, it's a different way of being, I think. Sort of, I suppose this is on a slightly similar track. The next question I wanted to ask you is, what's the novel that you always recommend to friends? I feel like this is a tricky question, because often people come back to us and say, you know, why is it a novel or only one novel? But if you had to choose one novel, is there a particular one that you would recommend to people?
Well, I actually would choose two, but that really, the number one would be Middlemarch. For a few reasons. One, because if you really want to know what the novel can do, it's not that it's the only novel that you could choose for that. But I mean, here is this masterpiece that is a love story. It's a study of provincial life, as her subtitle tells us. It's a story about the manners of a certain society in a certain time. It's also a philosophical novel. This is the most important thing. And again, it's not the only novel like this, but it's a novel that perhaps its main purpose is to explore. It's a philosophical novel in the sense that its purpose is to explore how a person should live. And in particular, the dilemma, you know, in a woman's life, you know, how a woman should live in a society that doesn't allow a woman the freedom to live that it gives to men. So, her novel is like what. You can move into it and live there for a while. Okay, that's also why I think it's so wonderful. And
that's a wonderful way of describing it, actually. Move into it and live there for a while.
And you want to, and it's a wonderful place to be. But two other reasons why it's special to me. There's a prelude, as you know. There's a famous prelude to Middlemarch, and she's talking about Saint Teresa of Avila, and how when she was a little girl she set out with her little brother because she had a fantasy about going on a religious pilgrimage, and then of course she grew up to be a great religious reformer, a writer. Was canonized. And in the second paragraph of that prelude, now I already had the title of my novel, The Last of Her Kind. I already had the title. And then something sent me to the bookshelf for some reason. I took down Middlemarch and turned to this. That Spanish woman who lived 300 years ago was certainly not the last of her kind. And I thought, isn't that wonderful that I found? And then she goes on to say, many Teresas have been born who found for themselves no epic life wherein there was a constant unfolding of far resident action, perhaps only a life of mistakes, the offspring of a certain spiritual grandeur ill-matched with the meanness of opportunity. Perhaps a tragic failure which found no sacred poet and sank unwept into oblivion. So she's talking about how Saint Teresa, who was a woman, was able to find, you know, an epic scope for her ambitions in religion. But the story that she's going to tell of Dorothea and other women, you know, they were her kind. They could have been her kind too, but they were not going to, but you know, that word, they were not going to have the opportunity, and that it would be a tragedy Now we know that Middlemarch does not end tragically, but you know, to me, it's before Virginia Woolf's time. It's her way of saying, if Shakespeare had a sister, she would have ended up drowned, right? I mean, so there's that, and then also I Middlemarch is a book that I read in the English novel course as an undergraduate, but sometime later with another one of those boyfriends that I lost along the way, we were living together, and he was a visual artist, and he would. I was still in graduate school, but he had a day job, and at night he would paint, and I would read out loud to him. And we began with the Middlemarch. And so this is a book have read out loud. I read out loud every page. It didn't even take as long as you might think, but every evening we did this, and it was just a wonderful experience. And so, I would always pick Middlemarch as number one, but I would also say Proust. Because, you know, particularly because of all the interest in auto fiction now, his name for some reason doesn't come up, right? But, you know, the
essay novel.
Yes,
you're right. It doesn't, does it?
Right. 100 years ago. I mean, think about In Search of Lost Time. And what is it? It's more nonfiction than fiction. It's called a novel. It's always been called a novel. Nobody disputes that it's a novel. It's a first-person narrator. It's essayistic. It's autofiction. That's what it is.
I've never thought of that before.
Huh. And, of course, it's, again, talk about moving in and living for a while. That's another one. So they're completely different novels, and they're, you know, if you look at them as two poles of what the novel can do, they're both full of ideas, full of characters, full of stories, romance, all kinds of everything you could want. But they're both novels, but they're completely different genres in many ways, clearly. So, but I love them both.
Well, they're perfect recommendations. You're making me want to go back and reread Middlemarch, which I haven't done for a while. And it might be, I suppose, a sort of going into what's almost a second lockdown might be a really good time to do that. So the next question I'm going to ask you, Sigrid, is some more, recommendations if people want to go and expand their reading. But I want to hear about a book or books that made you think about feminism in a new way. And I think you've got two titles you're going to tell me about.
Well, I thought first of all of The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir, and I also thought of A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf because I think of them as a pair in relation to what made me think of them to begin with. That wasn't very clear, but my point is that I read The Second Sex at a time when I really needed an antidote to a kind of criticism of feminist writing that was coming from all kinds of people, but including from women that I really admired. And the complaints were that feminist writing was anti-intellectual, simple-minded, sentimental, man-hating, of course, humorless, basically bad victim lit, though that wasn't the phrase that was used, ignorant of human history, very important, and ruined by rancor and self-pity. And the thing about The Second Sex, I mean, first of all, is that she doesn't apologize in any way for her vast learning, but also that, you know, because she does so much in that book. I mean, you know, it's a whole history of women, and it's all, I mean, and she talks about everything. She goes everywhere, and you know, I don't see how you could. It's not man-hating in any way. Not, I mean, perhaps humorless, but I don't think that really really applies in this case.
It's not really supposed to be comedy.
It's not really, exactly. So the intellectual rigor of that book and the breadth of knowledge and the way she's able to, to cover everything she presents the complexity of the whole issue of feminism. I hadn't seen that before, not in that way. She doesn't try to simplify any of it or try to talk down to the reader. I mean, her goal is to show precisely how complex the business is and how deep and rooted the oppression of women has been. And then something that I really don't think I had thought of before, though I should have, because certainly other women, other feminists, other writers had brought this up, but she's very good on women artists. And I guess this is the part that was very significant for me, because it's something I hadn't realized about myself and that I think is really important, that the problem that women have about wanting to please in general, but then that's also in the work, wanting to please and not wanting to shock and wanting to be on best behavior, and how limiting that is and how inhibiting that is and how that is just not the way any man would have felt. In fact, in some cases, the very opposite. I'm going to be in your face. I'm going to shock. For me, it was really important to have that lesson early and to always keep it in mind when working, that you can't be worried about your image. You know,
right.
And it's so hard not to. I remember once I was talking to someone who'd had a baby, and this was when we were young. And so I was very curious. I had to ask her certain things, and I don't know exactly what it was that I asked her, but she said, "Oh, when you're giving birth, you don't really worry about your image, if you know what I mean." Like, yeah, that's not on your mind, right? And I remember thinking, you know, I wonder what I'd asked her to make her answer like that. But it's very funny to me. But I think of it when writing. It's just like you don't want to be thinking about your image any more than it while you're giving birth. And I also like that she maintains in that book a hopeful tone. I think that's really important. And the same thing with A Room of One's Own, which I think comes right out of that, that there was something so brilliant about it coming from, you know, this idea, if Shakespeare had a sister. So as everybody knows, these A Room of One's Own came out of talks that she gave on women in fiction. And so that narrowed it down for me, because I was interested in that particular, in terms of feminism. And so for me, this is 1929, the sort of unapologetic way that she would present that, because to say if Shakespeare had a sister is to say that there could exist a woman of genius. And people didn't believe that. I mean, people did not accept that. And in her case, she also maintains a very hopeful tone, and she has, you know, that book has so much warmth in it, so much humor, so much charm, so much brio. It is it's a polemic, but it's like as entertaining to me as her novels. It's just such a delightful book, and I think something that. And I think this is really important, there's no self-pity in it. There's no self-pity in that book. And there's no, there's certainly no man trashing or man hating. And I do like, and it's as serious as any book could be about its subject, even though it is extremely light in many ways. But I'm very taken now by the way she rejects polarization. You know, that's, you know, there is this part where she really is, you know, trying to emphasize how we are we're not polarized. We're all in this together. And she encourages people to think beyond just the individual self. You know, the main thrust of her argument really is that, again, that it's not about you, that the writer's allegiance is to reality and not to self-expression or to the individual. And I just think that that's something that people forget now.
I was just thinking, it sounds like not only did they make you think about feminism differently, particularly if you read them at a sort of young, impressionable, and I mean that in the best kind of way, age, but it sounds like they've also had quite an influence on your own life as a writer and how you've thought about yourself and your writing and your ego as a writer and where it shouldn't be and where it should be and things like that.
Exactly. And the thing is, I guess, you know, I seem to remember that that I had an idea about feminism that was very limited. I mean, it was, you know, I didn't see the big picture. I thought it was there were all these excellent ideas, but I didn't see how it reached into my life as a writer, you know, really not as clearly. You know, all these things that Virginia Woolf brings up, because she goes through the history of women writing and not writing. And then there's that place where she says a woman writing looks back through her mothers. But I had just come from school where almost everyone we read was male. You know, so this was a new thing, and also her talking about a woman's sentence in her
right.
view. All this was a part of the writer's life, but was specifically about the woman writer's life, and the feminist view of it. And I had not seen any of that. Until I had some idea about it, but there's such clarity to the way she presents this. So you can't argue with her. You read it, you know that she's right.
Mm. Are they books that you return to since you first read them, or did they make such an impact at the time that they're not something you go back to?
The Second Sex, not in particular, but A Room of One's Own is actually a book that I have returned to with great pleasure, and I've also taught it. So and students do like it.
Yeah, no, I think it is one, isn't it, that sort of people keep going back to. And the final question, Sigrid, if I may, is, can I ask you to tell me, name a woman whom you admire? And this is such a tricky one to say, just one.
But I didn't think about it. I mean, you asked me that, I immediately think of the primatologist Jane Goodall. And, we're back to... We're back to animals.
This is such a right, and this is such a fascinating answer because of it. So please, yeah, tell me more.
Yeah, I adore her. I admire her so much, and it's very personal actually, because I remember a time when I was not that young. I was in my late 20s, and I was struggling with writing so much. And yet another one of those boyfriends that I lost.
I like these sort of unnamed boyfriends that slip through.
he said something that I thought was so... I was probably insulted by it at the time. But he said, this trying to be a writer is really making you so unhappy. You know, you're in the wrong field. You know, you should have done something that you love. You know, you should have, you should have been like tried to be Jane Goodall or something, you know? And I do know what he meant. He also at that time, you know, I think both Letterman and Johnny Carson on their shows would periodically have this woman, not the same woman, have a woman or a man, somebody come on with an animal and do a little segment about the animal. That was always a part of those shows. And my friend said, that should be you. That would have made you. And he was absolutely right that would have made me very happy, because I really do feel that a great lack in my life has been that I should have spent more time with animals. It would have made me happier to have more animals in my life. That's absolutely true. So I think of her, I could never have done what she did in a million years. But that's what's so nice about it, because I don't have to. She's doing it. But first of all, that it began with reading with her. You know, just like the rest of us. A little girl and your books and how happy you are as a child reading. I mean, that's true of everyone I know. I'm sure it was true of you. So she's reading these books, and she develops this dream. I love animals. I wanna go to Africa and study animals. Just a dream. And then she ends up, she's like 26, 27 years old, and this opportunity comes up for her to go to Tanzania and to the Gombe Preserve there and observe the chimpanzees. And she does it. She didn't even have a college degree at the time. She had no, she had no tools besides, you know, her pencil and her notes. She hadn't studied animal behavior. She goes there and then she's there, trying to do this job, and the chimpanzees will not cooperate. So she has to have all this patience and perseverance to sit there and wait and wait and wait. And she does, and eventually they accepted her, and she was able to make these observations that no one else had ever made before about them using tools, about chimpanzee warfare. About things that they ate that people always believed they didn't eat. And then, you know, she became this famous primatologist. And she, this relates to something we were saying before, she's somebody who insisted on giving names to the chimpanzees for which she was criticized. You should give them numbers, not names. That's the way it's done. Because of anthropomorphism, which is, of course, frowned upon in the scientific community. And she stuck to her guns about that, too, believing that you had to do a certain amount of that in order to observe them truly. Besides, she couldn't have helped herself. It is the way she saw them. They have personalities. And then through all this, she did. She had a marriage. She had a son. And after, after years of being an extremely important primatologist, she then, you know, became a conservation activist, which is what she still does. And, you know, there's a very famous quote where she says, "The least I can do is speak out for those who can't speak for themselves." Mm-hmm. So decades go on. She does this work. She does all this wonderful work. And, I don't know, one of the last things I saw about her in a documentary, she does not give up hope. She's another one. She's able to hold on to, she insists that there is hope, and she sees it in younger people. And I thought that was quite lovely. I've always admired her. Anytime there is a documentary or anything, I will always watch it. And I'm fascinated to watch her behave with these chimps. And I also thought it was so wonderful that she explained once when she had her son that she learned from a mother chimp named Flo. You know, she learned things about being a mother from Flo. I mean, you can imagine the hilarity.
How
in
fascinating.
Some corners. Absolutely fascinating. And you can imagine how certain people who feel another way about animals would respond to that. But certainly also from a feminist point of view, this woman was remarkable. I mean, absolutely heroic. That she could do something like this. And then a completely male dominated world.
And she made
a heroic life out of that. So I like to think of her, and I guess other people have this idea of there's someone out there living the life that I, you know, living it, a life for me that I could only dream about in all aspects. You know, I never got married. I never had a child. And I didn't get to study the chimps. I didn't get to have this close relationship. I'm not doing much to save the planet at the moment. She's doing all these things for me as my kind of ideal.
I love that. I love the idea of, yes, somebody else living the sort of other life that you could have had. But, you know, I must say that as a reader of your work, I'm very pleased that you chose the life that you did. Not least because I think also a life without animals for you has made you a particularly keen sort of chronicler of them in your fiction as well. So that's brought me much enjoyment. So thank you for that, Sigrid.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. Our Shelves is brought to you by the team at Virago Press. Special thanks to today's guest, Sigrid Nunez. Tune in next time for more conversation about books, feminism, and culture.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.